Watford, Johnson P. Sheldon, Petitioner's Counsel, Alice D. Armstrong, Senior Assistant Attorney General for the Commonwealth.
May I proceed? May it please the court. My name is John Sheldon. I represent Roy Watford. This case is a very unusual petition for writ of innocence. Mr. Watford pled guilty in 1978 to a rape of a 12-year-old girl and received 10 years of probation, no active jail time. In 2016, we did DNA testing, and it proved that Mr. Watford was not a contributor to any of the DNA that was found at the crime scene, including the vaginal pool DNA. We applied for writ of innocence to this court.
The vaginal sample was absolutely determined to be from the victim.
There has been no allegation that it was not from the victim, and in the DFS report, it states that it's from the victim AC.
So no questions of chain of custody, no questions of whether or not it actually is from the victim. There's really no questions at all about the quality of the DNA, am I right?
Yes, Your Honor. And in the response from the Commonwealth, they did concede that this case was unsettling, but argued that there was still one remaining fact, the unrecanted identification by the victim of Roy Watford. Now, in our reply, we disputed that. We said the record is not a clear identification of Mr. Watford, and if you think it is, remand this case for an evidentiary hearing, and you did. At that hearing, the victim, AC, made very clear that she never saw Roy Watford that day. She said that she was certain she saw Avelio, Roy's brother, and that she never saw Roy.
One of the questions that was asked at that hearing was whether her memory was better 40 years ago than it was now. And so if we counterbalance the name that was placed on Dr. Mady's exam room record with the memory now of "I never saw Roy Watford that day," how do we get his name on?
Two reasons, Your Honor. Good question. Two reasons. The first is when she said, of course, it took some effort when you read the transcript to get her to say her memory was better than the now. It did take some effort through leading questions on cross-exam, and eventually she said, yeah, okay, well, I guess my memory was better then, but she was unequivocal about two facts. I saw Avelio. I didn't see Roy. She was equivocal about the direct question you're asking, did she ever name Roy? I don't remember naming Roy, she says. But here's why you should not rely on that doctor's report as an accusation that it was Roy Watford. Because in that doctor's report, the doctor names Roy Watford by his nickname, Skip. The victim, AC, did not know Mr. Watford's nickname was Skip.
Again, how much... Those are the two counterpoints for me.
She was unequivocal. AC was unequivocal at the hearing.
Because she was unequivocal, I did not know it was Skip.
That I did not know his name was Skip, that his nickname was Skip. We do know that one of the Commonwealth's witnesses, Reginald Stitt, did know his nickname was Skip.
But Reginald wasn't in the exam room with AC, her mother, and the doctor.
We don't know what happened in 1978 and who said what to whom. And by the time the doctor took this report hours later, we don't know how that the name Skip got around.
Didn't the victim state that she went to this place where the incident occurred looking for Mr. Turner?
Mr. Watford.
Mr. Watford.
Absolutely. That day, AC and Roy Watford were friends, undisputed. Undisputed that AC went looking for Roy Watford that day. That is why I presume Roy Watford was eventually accused. That and because she did find her his brother, Avelio. But not only do we have AC's testimony, in which she is very clear that I did not see Roy Watford that day, but we also have two Commonwealth witnesses who were found and testified at this evidentiary hearing. One, Joseph Brown, testified unequivocally, I know the Watfords. I live three doors down. Roy Watford was not there that day. I went in the house. I saw three or four men. I don't know who they were, but they were not Roy Watford.
But didn't he also say that none of the Watfords went to the house?
He said, I didn't see. When I remember that Mr. Brown, when Joseph Brown entered the house, it was after the entire incident was over. And so Mr. Brown enters the house after the incident is over and doesn't see any of the Watfords, which makes sense with the DNA evidence. He doesn't see Avelio, even though AC, when she enters the house, sees Avelio. But it also confirms the DNA evidence. Avelio Watford's DNA does not match any of the DNA from the crime scene either.
But Mr. Brown's testimony that I went into the home, I rescued AC, and I didn't see any of the Watfords really doesn't help you because he didn't see Avelio, and she unequivocally testified that she did. So,
Your
whatever Watford may or may not
I completely disagree. Avelio Watford was there at the beginning and wasn't there at the end. He didn't rape AC. His DNA
I think you're missing... Well, maybe you're not missing my point. Maybe you're arguing against it. I'm just trying to figure out how that helps.
I'm not missing the point. I'm just saying that Mr. Brown, that the trial court found that Mr. Brown... The trial court made findings of fact and found that Mr. Brown went in the house, saw three to four males, didn't see Avelio Watford, and...
But
what we don't know is...
there earlier.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Point. And so Mr. Brown's testimony really is neither here nor there as to whether any of the Watford brothers were there that day.
Oh, I don't know how you could find that. The circuit court judge made findings of fact that Mr. Brown entered the house, saw three to four males, and didn't see the Watfords. The idea then, of course, is that Avelio had to leave in the interim. I don't find that hard to understand or believe in any way, that Avelio Watford was there when AC entered the house.
And was there, he got a blanket thrown over her head, but then he left.
And then he left. And why wouldn't you leave when a girl is attacked? And also, what confirms this is we have at least three DNA profiles, and those profiles don't match Avelio either. It makes sense that he left. Somebody was there. It appears as though three men were there. We have DNA profiles from three men, and it's not Avelio or Roy Watford. We also have another witness, Robert Jenkins, another neighbor, knew the Watfords well, knew the Stitt brothers well, says, I did see people I knew. I did see the Stitt brothers. I was out in front of that house. I knew something was going on in that house, and I never saw Roy Watford that day. In the Commonwealth's motion to dismiss, really, they do talk about his guilty plea, and he did plead guilty and got probation. But they rely on the...
After the guilty plea... correct me if I'm wrong, there were no incriminating inculpatory confessional statements made by Mr. Watford. Is that right?
That's right, Your Honor. So we're left here when we look at whether a rational trier of fact would have found proof of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. We're left with no statements. Unlike many other cases, you don't have Mr. Watford making a confession, making inculpatory statements. You don't have any identification from AC. You don't have any evidence of guilt at all. How would a rational trier of fact find Mr. Watford guilty based on what is the evidence that AC was looking for Roy Watford that day and saw his brother Avelio? That's what you're left with.
We still have to deal with the skip remark. I mean, it's just inexplicable where that nickname came from in the context from which it came.
Yes, but it's not inculpatory.
Right.
But yes, it is odd that the doctor is talking about skip. And AC has no idea who Skip is, so it seems as though it didn't come from AC. And it is confusing, but I think the record is unequivocal that AC never saw Roy Watford that day. And it's hard to imagine how any rational trier of fact could find any evidence of guilt, let alone guilt of proof beyond a reasonable doubt in this case. We're left with only the viewing of brother Avelio. And that's it, if we were going to look at a rational trier fact. A viewing of Brother Avelio, who did not contribute any DNA to the rape, and the fact that AC and Roy were friends and she was looking for him. I think it's not cutting against Mr. Watford. It probably explains why he was accused of this. This is also a case...
Walk me through why you say that. Why it also indicates why he was accused.
Well, I think what troubles the Commonwealth and probably the court is, well, Mr. Watford was accused. How is he accused of a crime that he didn't commit? And it seems obvious, this 12-year-old girl is looking for Roy Watford, finds her Mr. Watford's brother, and then can't describe his attackers. Otherwise, I have no idea why Mr. Watford was accused, but at least it explains how they came to wonder why it was him. Otherwise, there's no explanation that we can come up with why he was accused. It doesn't appear as though AC ever actually named Mr. Watford. We really are left with no evidence of that. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
Good morning again. May it please the court, Alice Armstrong on behalf of the Commonwealth, and with me at council table today is Assistant Attorney General Chris Ovenshane, who assisted in the evidentiary hearing in the Portsmouth Circuit Court. Your Honors, as the Commonwealth indicated initially in the initial papers, this is a difficult case. It's a challenging case.
Would you agree, counsel, that it perhaps has become more challenging for you after the fact-finding with her AC statement that she didn't see Roy Watford at the house that day?
I don't think that the evidentiary hearing changes the overall picture of this case all that much. She was very equivocal about many things. She did say that she didn't...
But that was the one thing that she appeared to be unequivocal about.
She said she didn't remember seeing... I mean, it's. She said she doesn't remember very much of this, and so I don't... This is the challenge. And we don't have any other record to balance it against.
So she remembers that she was looking for him that day.
She remembers that she was looking for him. She was riding her bike.
She remembers that she didn't. That she did not know him as Skip.
That's what she said.
And
that's what she says.
Okay. And she remembers seeing his brother?
She was very certain that she saw the brother at her testimony at the hearing. Yes,
I recall she was very certain she saw the brother and saw no one else. And so if she didn't see Roy Watford, how does that place him at the scene? How do you place him?
Well,
how
I mean,
the evidence place him.
Right. I think we have to look at the rest of the circumstances of what little bit of a record we do have in this case, which is what else do we have? We have his guilty plea. We have the doctor's notes.
And if we're going to look at the guilty plea, it's impossible not to be aware that he was given no time.
Oh, I understand.
Okay.
Absolutely.
But
it's still a verity.
I understand, yeah. And it's part of why the case is troubling.
There are many curious things. I mean, this is one of the challenges, I think, in a case with almost no record.
So go on to the next one. I mean, I interrupted you. Guilty plea plus.
The guilty plea, the doctor's contemporaneous notes, I mean, there's no other explanation for that. For the names, and it's got three names. I mean, it's got all three brothers.
If I understand the doctor's record, it's the doctor, AC, and AC's mother, and at least those three.
That's as far as I understand it. And the mother wasn't present at all the information that we do know, the mother wasn't present at this assault.
But we know that there was a conversation between AC and her mother prior to going to the hospital.
Correct. What we understand is that after the assault was completed, she went home to her mother and she reported. And her mother, as far as I can tell, immediately took her to the hospital where this report...
It's just as likely that it could have been her mother that said Skip Waffer as much as it could have been her. We have no idea.
We have no idea, but I don't know that her mother would have been able to say that without her report.
I guess what we've got, if I were to take two baskets and I were to say one convincing, the other curious, you've now given two facts that I will put in the curious basket. So good.
Right. And then we have the immediate focus on all three of the Watfords. We have from the probation officer's report that AC, when she was with Detective Kaiser, immediately pointed out the house where the brothers lived, Watford's father, and said that's where some of the assailants live, which actually is consistent with an accusation against Mr. Watford. That's where some of them live.
I thought it was that's where one of them lives.
Well, that would be consistent with her memory of Avelio.
The Commonwealth relies pretty heavily on the guilty plea. Rule 311 that requires a colloquy between the court and the defendant making a guilty plea was not in effect at the time.
I'm sorry?
Rule 311 was not in effect at the time. So there was no colloquy with Mr. Watford. There was no recitation of any facts in a plea agreement. There was no oral presentation of any evidence at the hearing. There is only a judge's handwritten, there has been a plea of guilty, 10 years, all suspended. Now, at the time, the U.S. Supreme Court had decided cases that indicated the lack of a colloquy would make guilty pleas untrustworthy, and as a result, the court enacted the first iteration of Rule 3:11, requiring them. So why should we give any credence to the guilty plea, especially when we know that the young man had intellectual deficits and his grandfather urged him to plead guilty so he could come home?
Well, I do want to say I don't know if there was a colloquy or not. I don't know what the practice was. I understand that Rule 311 wasn't in play, but I don't know what the practice was in that court. I did have a case from probably not quite that vintage where when there was a guilty plea, the Commonwealth actually put witnesses on, nevertheless.
Well, there's no written plea agreement.
Correct.
There's no transcript of any colloquy. And the sentence is surely extraordinary for a rape. 10 years, all suspended. It has every indices that let's solve this case and get it over with. His grandfather says, let's get it over with. You got it over with.
I understand, Your Honor. I mean, I can't go back in time and get us a plea colloquy or a transcript of a plea colloquy if it did happen. I don't know. That's one of the challenges here. What the other circumstance that I would note, though, is that we know there was a preliminary hearing, and we know this case was certified over to the circuit court. So I don't think I can agree that she never accused him. She must have. I mean, that's just the only reasonable inference that this case was certified over following a preliminary hearing. But I can't have any other explanation for that.
Let me move on. May I move on?
Absolutely.
We've got a really good segue now into could versus would. And I usually love the grammatical aspects of these cases. I've read N. Ray Altizer, and I'm not sure that I love how the Court of Appeals handled could versus would. I want to ask you, because number one, you're smart. Number two, I have I think that you were probably very familiar with how that played out in front of the General Assembly. How do you interpret could versus would? How should we interpret could versus would?
I think, and I am familiar with how that played out in the General Assembly, but the distinction I would draw and the reason for the change is that could is the appellate standard under Jackson versus Virginia, right? And so this court doesn't reweigh anything. This court just looks, I mean, and not to be facetious or to minimize what the court does, but essentially you're looking for elements or et cetera, essentially a checklist. Does the evidence, you know, could someone draw this conclusion from the evidence that was presented? Does it meet all of the tests? And if it does, then that's the end of the inquiry. The would is different because this court in an original jurisdiction proceeding, which is what we're talking about here, is the fact finder. You're not reviewing anything. You're weighing the evidence. And so the question is,
But interestingly, we're not weighing it in order to make the reasonable doubt analysis. We're weighing it to project what we think a rational fact finder would do with the facts that we conclude are now reliable.
Right. And the Supreme Court of the United States has touched on this in, I want to say House. I think I may have cited it in one of the pleadings. But
We actually touched on it in Lawler.
Right.
In Lawler, we looked at could versus would. And let me now give you what I would posit is the difference between could versus would and hear what your reaction to that is, whether you agree or disagree. Could is the ability to find that an element has been proven. Could a rational jury do that? Is there a rational jury out there somewhere that is able to find the person guilty based upon the evidence that we have? Would, on the other hand, is essentially probability. It's not, is it possible that some jury somewhere could do that? But would a jury on this evidence be likely to find guilt? Have I analyzed that in a reasonable fashion?
I think so.
How would you, argue with that?
I think that's a fair way to draw that distinction.
Okay, thank you.
The Court of Appeals seemed to be going in the direction of Justice Mims, and then at the end it concluded, as I understand their conclusion, that because of Carpenter, the petitioner still would have to prove that he is factually innocent of the offense. What is your, what in the light of the conversation you just had with Justice Mims, is your opinion with regard to that analysis, that conclusion? Is the Carpenter factual innocence standard still in play under a Wood standard? And can the two exist in the same plane?
I think they can. I think they do. Right? I mean, that's the conclusion that we came to in Harvard. A reasonable jury wouldn't have convicted him under the circumstances. So, but I do think that he has to prove factual innocence. There is not a writ of probable innocence. Likely innocence.
It's a matter of degree, and could is a little more attenuated than would.
Right. It is. But, I mean, the problem here is that I think this case would be a very, very different case.
Had you answered his question? Let me go back. Is the Wood analysis that Justice Mims just engaged in more of it would result in basically an acquittal of the defendant at the trial versus a finding of factually innocent?
And maybe this isn't the right answer, or maybe this isn't the appropriate way to analyze it, but I have always tried to view all of these cases as, if I were the juror and I was considering all these things, what would I do? And if I were the juror, if I feel like I would not have convicted, then that informs my decision making. I don't know if that's the correct approach to suggest to the court, but...
But that doesn't mean someone is factually innocent just because you would not find them guilty.
I think the evidence has to be of that character, though, that we're convinced that he is factually innocent and therefore would not convict, I guess, is sort of where I am. I'm not articulating it very well.
Let me engage in this. I'm not going to... I appreciate the fact that you would put yourself under the shoes of the court. I think highly of you, and that's one of the reasons why. I'm not going to ask that question. I'm going to ask you, based upon the facts that you've outlined, would a reasonable juror find this individual guilty beyond a reasonable doubt? If those are the only facts that are presented.
By clear and convincing evidence.
By clear and... Right. And given everything that I've outlined, I think they, well, I say they would. And the reason is because I don't know that this DNA goes as far as, I don't have any problem with the test results that were reported. But the problem we have is that we have a three and possibly, I mean, this came out at the evidentiary hearing, possibly four perpetrator offense. And as far as we know, there was only one act of penetration by one perpetrator. So the fact that he's eliminated from the DNA, I don't think exonerates
him. The only evidence we have of his presence is that someone put his name, using his nickname, on the sheet, and we don't know why or how or anything else.
I understand.
In answering Justice Mims' question, you defaulted to the DNA is not conclusive. But what about the other evidence that was gathered at the fact-finding? Don't we also have to factor that in?
But the only...
The unequivocal...
The only thing that he can rest his claim on is the DNA in these proceedings.
In another context, in this court's jurisprudence, where we've looked at whether or not there's error in the finding below. And that's basically what you're doing in a writ of actual innocence case. You're looking, is there an error made here? In Commonwealth versus White in 2017, we went through a whole series of cases. We were looking at the harmless error doctrine to answer the question. And what we said is that in answering that question to determine whether an error has been made, is it clear beyond a reasonable doubt that the fact finder would have returned a verdict of guilty? And then we followed it up. The standard is not the same thing as simply asking whether the legally admitted evidence was sufficient to support the conviction. The sufficiency standard asks whether a rational jury could have found the defendant guilty. The harmless error standard instead looks at the other side of the reasonable doubt spectrum. Is it clear beyond a reasonable doubt that a rational fact finder would have found the defendant guilty absent the error? Given that harmless error doctrine is actually analyzing whether there was an error in the case below, and the writ of actual innocence is analyzing whether there was error in making the conviction, why shouldn't we adopt the same dichotomy that we have in Commonwealth versus White and affirm that this is a probability analysis and not an analysis of whether it could have been done? It's whether a jury would have under the circumstances and in the context of the case. We've already said it in that one line of cases. Why shouldn't we adopt it here?
I don't have any... I mean, we haven't raised it, so I don't have any particular argument against that, Your Honor. I think the only thing is, right, we have to make sure that what we really are coming in with is new biological evidence that otherwise satisfies the statute. But then in drawing the line on where wood falls, I don't know any reason why that would be an unfair way to draw the line.
All right, well, thank you for your candor.
Let me ask one more question, Chief, because I'm not sure what the Commonwealth's position is with regard to what this court can consider. Obviously, it comes to us on the basis of DNA, but 32.327.5 would indicate that this court can consider previous records of the case, the record of any hearing held under this chapter, and any findings certified from the circuit court. So, I'm understanding that we consider the DNA and the findings from the circuit court. You're not disagreeing with that?
I'm not disagreeing with that.
Thank you, Ms. Armstrong. I have reason to believe this may be your last appearance in front of us.
It is, and if I can ask counsel's indulgence and the court's indulgence, this is my last appearance before the court, and I wanted to say thank you very much.
Well, we want to thank you for your advocacy on behalf of the Commonwealth as well.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
It has been a great pleasure to work with Ms. Armstrong, although I do disagree with her in this case quite strongly. I think I'm finding it curious that all the weight being put on the double hearsay unsworn doctor's report versus the sworn testimony of AC, which you're faced with, and would any rational fact finder have found proof of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Weigh the sworn testimony, which I understand you're going to
look at unless plainly wrong. The sworn testimony, the circuit court has made a finding from that sworn testimony that AC did not see Watford that day. When you weigh it with the double hearsay unsworn doctor's statement, I don't see how you can come to any conclusion other than AC did not see Roy Watford.
And your argument that it's unsworn would indicate it's not a an exception to the hearsay rule because it was not for the purpose of treatment.
It's certainly double hearsay, and it's unsworn. And I'm not, in fact, I'm not arguing that you can't consider it. I'm just saying that you should give it almost no weight under the facts of this case and under the fact that then you got AC sworn, giving testimony, and a fact finder has found that she didn't see Roy Watford that day.
May I ask you before you run out of time,
yes.
how do you see the conflict as the Court of Appeals saw it between the statement that you have to prove that he's factually, actually innocent versus you have to prove simply that no rational fact finder would have convicted him? Because as we all know, when judges and juries say you're not guilty, we're not saying anyone's innocent. They may not be innocent at all. It's just that the evidence didn't prove them to be guilty. Very different. How do we reconcile those two statements? They're in the same statute.
Yes. I had looked at them and thought that this court really has two very similar but slightly competing duties, and that is we do have to prove that Mr. Walker is innocent under subsection double I and under subsection 7 that no, you know, by clear and convincing evidence, both of them, that no rational trier fact would have found him guilty. And the fact that you have to make two very similar findings, but there is a little bit of difference in them. I hadn't seen that as a problem, just two findings that you have to make.
I'm sorry, did you say that we do have to find that he's factually innocent?
I think subsection little I, double I, 2, says that the petitioner is actually innocent of the crime for which he is convicted.
That's what he has to plead.
Yes, and he is.
That's what he has to plead, but then below that we only have to find 4 through 8. By clear and convincing evidence.
Okay, and I'm sorry, I don't have the statute in front of me, so maybe I should stop talking about that. And let me say instead that you are left in this case with no evidence of Mr. Watford's guilt. None. A rational trier fact would look at AC's sworn statement, the DNA results, the witnesses that were subpoenaed by the Commonwealth, Stitt, Brown and Jenkins, we didn't even talk about Stitt. All three Commonwealth witnesses say, we know Roy Watford, he wasn't there that day. You are left with no evidence of Mr. Watford's guilt. And this standard is extremely easy for Mr. Watford to meet. In addition, the prosecutor, as you all have noted, 10 years of probation for a rape of a 12-year-old, the prosecutor in this case has provided you an affidavit saying he supports the grant of the writ of innocence. The law enforcement does not oppose the grant of the writ. I don't know how in any case we could get a stronger case of lack of evidence of guilt than this. And we ask that you, Mr. Watford asks that you grant him the writ of innocence. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.